We can begin today by turning to Daniel chapter 3 to continue our study of this fascinating man's life. And I've entitled the Bible study, It's Cool in the Furnace. I would like to claim the creativity for that title, but I remember many, many years ago, there is actually a musical by that title that we had our young people perform in the Toledo church, so I give them credit for it. It's Cool in the Furnace at first may sound as a misnomer, but in reality, if we look at the story of Daniel chapter 3, for those that believed God, it was in fact cool in the furnace. And we're not talking about the manner of speaking that so many practice today when they say, you know, that's really cool. And that's cool. I mean, it's a manner of speaking, but sometimes I wonder whether or not we have dumbed down our language skills to the point where we can no longer use appropriate adjectives, and then we just, it's like, and it's cool. But I'm off topic. Let's go to Daniel chapter 3 and begin reading. And I'd like to point out, after reading verse 1, a couple of things just to by way of background. But we have here, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar went on a massive construction project, and he built an image of gold 60 cubits high. Now, a cubit in Israel was approximately 18 inches. So it's roughly the length of from the tip of your finger to your elbow. And, you know, some languages bring that out. In German, it's translated L, in reference to Elbogen. So it was roughly the measure of tip of your finger to your elbow. There were also, in Babylon, it was about 20 inches, so apparently the Babylonians were a little bit bigger. But in any case, if you take that particular conversion, Nebuchadnezzar's image was 90 to 100 feet tall. So it was a pretty big piece of work, and there, you know, it's argued about whether or not there was a base for the image, or whether the image itself was that tall. And I think this bears out an important point, because in contrast to the description of the image that we read about in Daniel chapter 2, which is very detailed, the image that is described here is not described in as much detail. And I point that out because the central message of the chapter is not the image, but rather the fiery furnace. In contrast to Daniel chapter 2, in which the image carried the message. I'd also like to point out that most commentators will note that there was a gap of time between Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 3. It is not a contiguous narrative, but a collection of independent accounts from the life of Daniel. So it's not like what Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream was immediately followed by the event in chapter 3, as it might appear if you just read through here. It's also clear that Nebuchadnezzar, while he said in chapter 2, verse 47, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. So while Nebuchadnezzar recognized that The God of Daniel was the God, and notice what he said, the God of gods. He did not recognize that the God of Daniel was the only God. So perhaps that gives us a little bit of background. You know, a king at that time would have recognized Daniel's God as a, as he put it here, a revealer of secrets, but not necessarily the only one to which worship should be given. Expositor's Bible Commentary says this: it seems that Nebuchadnezzar didn't really get the point from Daniel's interpretation of his dream that there is only one true God. As this chapter opens, the king decides to build a huge idolatrous image or statue. There is no indication that the image was of the king himself. It may have been a representation of his patron god Nebo. The people's prostration before Nebo would amount to a pledge of allegiance to his viceroy. So, from our perspective, you know, you can ask the question, you know, why did Nebuchadnezzar do such a thing when he just had this dramatic experience in the previous chapter? You have to put it into the cultural context. I am sure there will be people that will look back at the history that we are building right now in the church and in our country, and they'll say, what was wrong with those people? How could they possibly have not objected to abortion, to pick an example? They must have been barbaric. You know, we are conditioned by the culture in which we live, and a king, even more so, particularly since he embodied law. You know, somebody could advise him to do differently. But in the end, he did what he wanted to do. Continuing in verse 2, and King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers and judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So you can just kind of imagine the pageantry with all of these noblemen and all of these VIPs coming together. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces, stated another way, everybody that was somebody or thought they were somebody was there. Except Daniel. We'll talk about that in a minute. And all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music." Wow, you know, what a presentation. All the musicians of every type, and it names horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery. It names five different instruments in specifically, but then mentions all other kinds of music. So it was a full symphony. I mean, this was a big deal. Everybody was there. You talk about peer pressure. "You shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." And then there's a little motivation, you know, just in case somebody got up that morning and wasn't particularly energetic. Here's the, you know, the little bit of a boost to get them going. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. That's Babylonian due process. You don't spend millions of Nebuchadnezzar's money to make sure that you were not handicapped in such a way that you were unable to fall down. You didn't have 100 appeals. No. If you didn't fall down, you were to be cast immediately into the burning cauldron, the smelter of iron, as it would have been. That's the culture. That is the system of laws. And that is the country in which Daniel and his three friends lived, which makes Daniel's impeccable demonstration of faith even more impressive. There were no First Amendments. There was no Constitution. Well, except Nebuchadnezzar was the Constitution. There were no protections. There was Daniel, and then there was God. And maybe that's not such a bad thing. So at the time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Wow. What a bunch of spineless followers. Everybody bowed. And you know, we have seen similar things occur in the not too distant past, where individuals got enamored by a particular leader. It always ends badly. It always ends badly. Because human beings are incapable of handling power that is not in some way curbed. And Nebuchadnezzar, as we will see in subsequent chapters, was no exception. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. Oh, this was wonderful political opportunity. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O King, live forever. It's a marvelous accolade and demonstration of great respect. You, O King, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Did you not say that? And of course, they had a big agenda, in which they thought they would get themselves promoted and dispense with these troublesome Jews. You see a modern parallel of that? You see, fundamentally, brethren, things don't change. When it comes to politics and power and the administration thereof, things don't change. There are certain Jews whom you, oh, have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. And, you know, you gave them this big honor, and now they don't even do what you say they should be doing. I mean, the jealousy, the politics just spill out on every side. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. It becomes a challenge. And this is what politically inclined people do. They watch for an opportunity such as this one. And then they put the leader into an impossible situation. You know, what are you going to do? You know, and what do? They step back. As politically motivated people always do. You put it out there. And then you step back. Because fundamentally, politically inclined people are concerned about one thing, themselves. So they'd done their job, right? They had the king right where they wanted, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, you don't need much imagination to kind of imagine what that would have looked like. I mean, they're sitting there grinning. Gotcha, is the word. But they made the mistake that all politicians do, and that is they factor God out of the equation. Or I should say, politically inclined individuals. I mean, right now you got all the politics going on, so you tend to think of politics in terms of a politician and forget that what we so disdain about the process is done by people of all sorts and echelons that are politically inclined. Happens every day. And that's why due process is so important. Because often things are not as they appear to be. And a little bit of due process can go a long way of preventing this type of escalation from happening. Where was Daniel in all this? The answer is, we don't know. The Bible doesn't say. He was not there for whatever reason. I mean, there expositors makes some speculations from perhaps he was absent from Babylon at the time. Perhaps he was in government business. Perhaps he was in the king's cabinet. Perhaps he was ill. The answer is we don't know. He wasn't there for whatever reason. His three friends, who, if you recall, had fasted with him, and Daniel, instead of assuming all power to himself, asked the king to share his responsibilities with these three individuals. And I am sure that did not please the politically inclined of his day. So now they're back on the carpet. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, probably realizing, you know, this is not good, But it was the law of the Medes and the Persians which couldn't be changed. And rage and fury gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. And again, now we get to the heart and soul of the message of the chapter. The image is secondary. Maybe even tertiary. It becomes a question of whether or not they will stand for the truth, irregardless of consequences. And then when that decision is made, it is no longer a contest between Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Nebuchadnezzar the king. It becomes a contest between Nebuchadnezzar the king and God. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Is it true? Yes or no?" Have you ever noticed, particularly in a political cycle, politicians are incapable of answering yes or no questions? Did you know? And I always find it interesting how people respond. Now, they also didn't answer with yes or no, but notice what they did say. Now, if you are ready in the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? It was no longer a contest between the king and Daniel's three friends. It was a contest between the king and God. And who is the God who will deliver you from my all-powerful hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We're not going to equivocate. We don't need to make an excuse." I mean, they could have said, I mean, imagine if they would have been as politically inclined as their political foes. They could have made up all kinds of excuses. "Well, you know, I had a backache today. We're sorry, Your Honor, but, you know, we just couldn't do it." And, you know, instead, they were very clear. "If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver..." Sorry, "If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." You know, this message speaks to our generation, doesn't it? Because Revelation talks about the worship of a beast and his image. And it will become an individual question on whether or not we will or won't. The example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are both inspiring and instructive in this regard. Let's go back and notice a couple of things that they said. If this is the case, our God, whom we are able to deliver... I keep misreading that. If this is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. But notice, and he will deliver us from your hand, O King. They understood without a moment's hesitation that even if God chose to let them succumb to the forces of the laws of physics and be burned to a crisp, vaporized as it were, that even then God would in effect be delivering them from the king's hand. And they would rise again in a resurrection to the life that was predicted in the revelation that God gave to Daniel in the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had had. Their faith was sure. And, you know, they were doing this in the presence of all of the important people in the country at that time. Verse 18, they said, "But let it be known to you, O King, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have made." Not only had they defied the king's order, but they told him to his face. Verse 19, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated." You know, what kind of furnace are we talking about? Again, I cite expositors. Apparently, there was no door or screen to hide the inside of the furnace from view. Judging from bas reliefs, I mean, there are inscriptions on clay tablets that have been unearthed that show the type of technology that was extant at that time. It would seem that Mesopotamian smelting furnaces tended to be like an old-fashioned glass milk bottle in shape, with a large opening for the insertion of the ore to be smelted, and a smaller aperture at ground level for the admission of wood and charcoal to furnish heat. Now, I don't know how many of you have been in a steel mill where they actually melt the ore. But when you talk about a burning cauldron, you know, if you've been to one of those, it's very understandable what we will read here in a minute, that those that threw the men in, I mean, if you're going to take a person and toss them into a burning cauldron, well, you have to get pretty close. I mean, how far can, you know, even if you're a big football-playing, quarterback-sized individual, you know, you can't toss a man very far. Maybe 2 yards, I don't know. But if you get within that space of a burning cauldron of a smelting furnace, I mean, you're going to have a problem yourself. Continuing, "There must have been 2 or more small holes at this same level to permit the insertion of pipes connected with large bellows." You know, when it talks about the furnace being heated seven times more than it was usually heated, I don't think that means to seven times the temperature. I mean, it doesn't actually say that. It says that they heated it seven times more. And the way you get the higher temperatures that are necessary for smelting, which will be over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, is by introducing compressed air. And in those days, it would have been a bellows. So I'm assuming that what isn't meant here is that they pumped those things seven times more to really get the fire going. When it was desired to raise the temperature beyond what the flue or chimney could produce, these bellows were used. Undoubtedly, the furnace itself was fashioned of a very thick adobe resistant to intense heat. The large upper door was probably raised above the level of the fire bed so that the metal smelted from the ore would spill on the ground in case the crucibles were upset. So the text says that the three fell down into the fire. Apart from the swirling flames and smoke, then, they were quite visible to the outside observer, though, like the king, he would have had to stand at a distance. That's expositors. Note on verses 9 through 23. Now let's read the text. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor. And he got a couple big guys who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Now notice the detail that is given here. It details fairly specifically what they were wearing, all of which was very flammable material. You know, turbans, trousers, and their other garments. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Isn't it an honor to be in the king's army? You know, you get to toss people into furnaces and then die yourself in the process. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. That should have been the end of the story. The symphony should have started playing, and the king should have gotten up and said, "See what happens to men that challenge me and the gods." And no doubt that was precisely what King Nebuchadnezzar was expecting. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, that would have been an interesting job, an advisor to the king. What happens if I give him advice he doesn't like, you know? Become a bowling ball, or a part of me becomes a bowling ball. Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." Notice, I mean, all of a sudden, they were able to give concise answers. Not a 60-second opinion to take up the available time so that you can't ask another question. "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." You know, it's no question that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was surprised, and as I mentioned before, the Babylonians believed in multiple gods. And actually, the original Aramaic here means like a son of gods. So he's noticing that not only did his dramatic execution plan fail, and these men were walking around in the exceedingly hot fiery furnace that had killed those that tossed them in, and it gotten reinforcements. They were, whoever they were creating more of them, because they received, as he put it, someone that was in the form of a son of the gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Notice how he changed his approach. Servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here. Come to me. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. You see, they obeyed the king when it did not contradict the commandment of God. And they came out. You know, this is an important principle that we see repeated in the New as well as in the Old Testament times prior to Daniel. Let's go over to Job chapter 13. Keep your place here. We'll come back to it. Job chapter 13, verse 15. Job said, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. Job understood what the disciples later proclaimed when they were in front of the authorities. Those that should have known better in their particular case, when they stated, we ought to obey God rather than men. That's a pretty clear principle. We just need to make sure that we know who we are obeying. Hebrews chapter 11 also talks about those, you know, in Hebrews chapter 11 you have those that did great wonders and God resurrected them from the dead, and it goes on, and then it also enumerates those that died, that God did not protect. So it was not clear, even to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, on whether or not their preservation was ensured. But what was very clear to them was what they needed to do, and that was to obey God. The outcome, if you look at the example throughout the Bible, the outcome is often determined by whether or not it becomes a contest, whether or not God's name is somehow being called into question, whether God is going to be honored in the end. Verse 27, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of the fire was not on them. Try that out in a steel mill. I guarantee you, even if you're going there and you visit and you come back out, even in you know, the modern facilities, there will be a smell. They were in the smelter and came out unharmed, unsinged, and untainted by the smell. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. And now the wonder and the expediency of unfettered power. Therefore I make a decree that all people, nations, or languages which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be, and now here comes the motivation again, cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap. You know, that was standard procedure back then, remember? Very similar consequence that was offered up against the magicians and the soothsayers who could not answer the question. Because there is no other God who can deliver like this. What he didn't say was from me. But that was really the point. The king was defeated by an invisible, well, I guess his agent was visible, but let's just say by an invisible, all-powerful God that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego served. And being the good despot he was, he needed to save face. So what did he do to ensure that people would not recognize him for what he was, and that was a defeated despot? What did he do? He issued another decree threatening all of those who now don't worship the God who he had just punished or attempted to punish unsuccessfully, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And if you don't now worship him, you will suffer, well, I don't know what is worse, getting thrown into a burning cauldron or getting chopped up into pieces and my assets being turned into an ash heap. But it, you know, illustrates, I think, very dramatically why what we have enjoyed in this country for the past 250 years is an historical anomaly. And the benefits of due process in which arbitrary and unfettered power is not vested in one individual. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. It is a powerful story. I never cease wanting or being inspired by reading. Because there, it is faceted in so many different ways, but the central message is still that our objective must always be to yield our full allegiance to God and to God alone, and to do so fearlessly. And if we do, perhaps turning to Psalms chapter 66, verses 10 and 12 is an appropriate conclusion. Psalm chapter 66. Verse 10. Is it not you, O God, who cast us off? And you, O God, who did not go out with our armies, give us help from trouble. Wait a minute. I'm in chapter 60. That didn't sound right. Chapter 66. Verse 10. For you, O God, have proved us. You have refined us as silver is refined. You have brought us into the net. You laid affliction on our backs. You have caused men to ride over our head. We went through fire and through water, but you brought us out to rich fulfillment. We are not promised an easy route. Only what often seem to be correct but difficult decisions. But what we are promised in the end is a sure victory that no one can take from us, not even Nebuchadnezzar, because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego understood that even if they would have been vanquished in the burning cauldron, in doing so, they would have actually been delivered from the king's hand. So I hope that in reading and looking at a very familiar passage of scripture, we gain confidence for the road ahead and make our decisions sure and in confidence, the same confidence that they demonstrate so dramatically. Because in the end, we will be rewarded, as it says here in Psalms chapter 66, verse 12, rich fulfillment.